to her vocabulary as the Daniel-approved substitute for damned. That she had heard Nicholas saying damned had proved a far less incontrovertible defense than she had expected it would.
It hurts. A lot. He was more than a conjurer. I keep hoping he'll pop back up, nattering on about how I can't even put away the laundry he's washed and folded for me. Before, when he was gone, I could still sense him flitting around the periphery. I even caught sight of him every so often. This time, there's nothing.
He rocked back and forth a bit, his regard hardening as his mouth pulled into a tight pucker.
I think I need to say goodbye to him.
Alice reached around the mound of narcotics and placed her hand over his. We should hold a memorial for him. A spark returned to Hugo's eyes.
No, he said. Not a memorial. A wake.
12. Natalie heard an insect-like whirring, punctuated by a metallic rattling that seemed to be synchronized to an almost imperceptible fluctuation in the brightness of the faint light beyond her closed eyelids. The air around her felt stifling and dank at the same time, swampy. At regular intervals, a weak breeze slithered over her skin. Natalie stitched the various impressions together into a reasonable explanation. There was a fan, oscillating, causing aluminum blinds to tap against a window frame. A flash of her SUV cruising along 10, heading east, out to Grunch Road. Why had she been headed there? Alice. Something about Alice. She remembered finding Mrs. Perot, looking like a writhing Pietà, struggling to drag a corpse onto a plastic tarp. A creeping black mist that devoured everything, the corpse, the tarp, the blood, and, Natalie remembered, as she wiggled the toes on her bare right foot, her shoe. Then it hit her, the creeping black mist, the demon that had tried to drag Alice into the pit. They had felt the same. Natalie was heading out to Grunch Road to look for evidence before worrying Alice, but she hadn't made it there. Hitting an invisible barrier at 50 miles an hour and flipping ass over latchkey, the windshield shattering into a million tiny prisms. Natalie felt for the earth around her, still halfway expecting asphalt, but she was lying on an uncovered mattress, low enough her hand draped over its side and touched a wooden floor. Her skin felt damp and sticky, clammy, like waking after a fever has broken. Her SUV skidding along on its roof, spinning 360s as it did so. She felt weighed down, pinned in place not so much by gravity as by a heavy scent, at once earthy and spicy, musty but laced with incongruous sweet notes of honey and citrus. She opened her eyes. Dull gray light. Dusk? White ceiling. Mold growing overhead formed an image like one of those inkblot things. A Rorschach. To Natalie's confused mind, desperate to impose meaning on her disorientation, the shape the mold formed was at once the all-seeing eye, the eye of Horus, and the Ichthus pendant she'd received as a confirmation gift. Thinking she might die, wondering if she might already be dead, praying she wouldn't end up a ghost of December. Natalie tried to rise, but nausea washed over her and knocked her back, hard. The room didn't so much spin as rock. She became consciously aware of an eyeball-busting headache. Darkness, waking with a gasp, the breath too painful to push back out as a scream. She pushed back against the pain, trying to reconstruct the sequence of events that would explain where she was and how she had gotten here. Hanging upside down, restrained by her safety belt. Beyond that, Natalie had floated in darkness, not the safe sea of the womb, but a cold, airless nothing. Despite the surfeit of light, she had witnessed silver, glitter-like flecks falling all around her, giving her the sensation of being trapped in an ink-filled snow globe. She had reached out, not with her hand, but with her mind, and caught hold of one of the glints. Natalie had found herself looking at a teary teenage boy looking out. The glint was both a mirror and a window. In that singular moment, Natalie could feel the energy of the boy's raw, red-faced self-loathing flowing through the mirror into her, burning and bitter, yet as fortifying as her morning coffee. Natalie had startled as terrifying memories from her childhood surged in. Babu Jean scratching, clawing at the wrong side of her bedroom mirror. The glass had cracked and splintered in her grasp, sending a shock through her. That shock was what had first made her aware of this place. She heard a shuffling, leather-soled shoes on creaking, rotting wood, the scent of honeyed citrus, and it dawned on her, bay leaves grew stronger. A shadow fell over her. It put her in mind of another shadow. So Natalie tried to rise again, this time with more grit. But she only succeeded in forcing herself up on her elbows and pushing back an inch or two. The room reeled around her, and she collapsed back into the thin, musky mattress. She tried to speak. She tried to scream. But nothing came out beyond panicked, meeping gasps.
Mais ma fillette, a patronizing voice said, stretching the final syllable into a slow, husky glissando. Souviens-toi pas de ton tonton, Emile? A man with a deeply tanned, deeply lined face bent over her. His hair was a thick, steel-gray mass of untamed cowlicks, his eyes as blue and bright and unnerving as police car lights in a rearview mirror. He looked far too happy, his expression exaggerated, like the face you'd make when playing peekaboo with a baby. This man on his knees, peering in at her, grinning. She saw the glint of a ruby ring as a pale hand reached over her, felt his palm over her forehead. Cool, calming. Still, Natalie's mind protested she wasn't a little girl, not by anyone's standards, and although there was something familiar about his face, she had never heard of an Uncle Emile on either side of her family. She got another whiff of his cloying aftershave. The perfume was strong, kind of like he had bathed in it, but it failed to mask his close-up scent of sour sweat and menace. Her eyes traveled from his strong, calloused hand up his thick forearm, to a rounded, solid bicep. He wore a tight, graying t-shirt. His hair might be gray, and his face weathered, but the rippling beneath that shirt showed his muscles were still wound as tight as rubber bands inside a golf ball.
"I'm very sorry, sir. I'm sure it's my fault," Natalie said, slipping into the politeness she reserved for passengers who made her uncomfortable enough to begin calculating the minimum force it would require to fight them off, should the need arrive. "But I don't know you." He shook his head as his mouth pulled into a sad or perhaps disapproving pucker.
"Course you don't, Cher. But it ain't your fault. That's your bitch mother's doing. Took you away from your family. Took you and your papa both. Never got around to sending either of you back, neither."
He seemed to study the space around her, scanning it from left to right like he was reading a text printed in the air.
Shame she didn't hang herself years before she finally got around to it.
Natalie couldn't find words. Yes, her mother had hanged herself. In Corpus Christi. After Katrina. In Natalie's mother's sister's attic. Her mother's sister, not her aunt. Natalie had sensed the passing, but might never have known the details if a note from the sister hadn't arrived 2 years later, after having followed her to Natchitoches, back to New Orleans, and through 3 different apartment moves around the city. The thin, worn envelope had carried a dozen forwarding stamps on its face. Inside was a news clipping and a yellow sticky note with the words, "This is on you," printed in red felt tip.
"You weren't right. Never were."
Her mother's flat, sour-breathed lamentation sounded anew from this man's mouth.
"I knew it from the second they put you in my arms."
Somehow, this man had zeroed in on the single most painful memory Natalie held of her mother. This was the day her mama had sent Natalie to live on the streets. Natalie had been 14. She found herself reliving the moment in a visceral way that went beyond mere memory. Her mama had met her on the front steps of their house that day. She could still see the faded floral cotton shift dress her mama had worn beneath a threadbare maroon cardigan, despite the steam rising up after the rain from the late July sidewalk.
"I should have grabbed you up by the ankles when I could still swing you and bash your brains against the wall."
The memory cut off, but Natalie felt her own lips moving, silently mouthing the words that remained burned into her.
"If I'd known what you'd grown into, I would have. It would have been a kindness."
Her mother hadn't been talking about magic. Emil laughed.
"Your mama had the ideal neck for hanging. Scrawny pale, too long. Bet it snapped,"
he said, snapping the fingers of his free hand as he spoke the word, "like a twig." "Stop it," Natalie said, her shocked rage pushing her upright, doing what fear and willpower could not. Natalie held her hand out toward him. Sizzling red sparks danced along her fingertips.
"Regarde,"
he said, with a derisive snort.
"La chanson sait sortir ses griffes."
He focused on her hand, and it began to tremble.
"You aren't like your spindly little mama, though. You got sturdy Boudreaux neck, and a sensible Boudreaux head riding on it. That's why you aren't going to try any more of your nonsense on Tonton Emile again, you hear?"
Her hand spasmed into a painful cramp.
"I asked you if you heard me."
She felt like her fingers were being crushed and pulled apart at the same time. The agony came over her so fast and strong, it took Natalie a moment to realize that Emile was causing it, that he was punishing her.
"Yes. Yes."
"Yes, what, Sha?"
"I heard you,"
she gasped out, and the pain fell away. He sat on his haunches and gazed into her eyes.
"Affiette, you couldn't know no better," he said,
his tone a parody of tenderness, conciliatory to the point of saccharine.
"I should have sought you out sooner, but before,"
he shrugged.
"Well, it's only that you bloomed so late, I figured you might be too much your mama, and not enough Boudreaux. At least the part of Boudreaux that matters."
She closed her eyes and drew in one deep breath after another, letting them out slowly, doing her best to calm her pulse, to calm her mind, to regain control of her faculties. But then a realization hit her.
"You crashed my car."
Her eyes popped open, and she was too danged mad to care about the way her whole head felt, like it might pop open, too. You could have killed me.
Mais non, chat. Jamais. Just needed to get your attention.
His voice was calm, but Natalie could hear the patience draining from it as he spoke, like he was answering the umpteenth question from an overly curious child.
Now you sit still for a moment.
Before she could pull back, his hands shot out and grasped the sides of her head. At first, she felt only panic, but then the thundering in her head gave way, and her vision righted itself. The head-to-toe soreness she felt eased away and was replaced by a sense of vitality. Natalie hadn't felt this good since she was a teenager.
There you are.
He pulled his hands away and beamed down at her.
Your tonton added a few years back to make up for the inconvenience,
he said, lingering on the word, morphing each and every vowel he could into its nasal French cousin, even managing to add two extra syllables. What do you mean?
I mean you waking up tomorrow younger than you did today. Provided, that is, you wake up at all.
He held up a cautioning hand.
Not a threat. At least not from me. Just telling you something that deep down you already know.
Without even trying, Natalie could pick up precise details about the near future of any random stranger, but it was rare for her to get an insight into what was coming her own way. This time, Natalie thought maybe this guy was right. She could feel a premonition brewing. She had ever since she had dropped Mrs. Perot off at her house late last night. Her mind applauded itself as it put this missing piece of the puzzle back into place, then stopped as it dawned on her she had no idea how long she'd been out. Might have been last night. Might have been last year. It was this sense of an approaching crisis, a big one involving Alice, that had sent her out to Grunch Road.
Those demons you came across with the voodoo woman, he began, then wagged a finger in her face. No use trying to lie to me. I've always been able to see through you, he said. And through you, too.
He held up his hand and turned it so she could see the gleam of the ruby he wore on his ring finger.
I can see through anyone's, well, most anyone's eyes, thanks to this.
He drew closer and held his hand out so she could examine it.
C'est un joli truc, no?
No, the stone wasn't the least bit pretty. It took an act of will for Natalie to look at it at all.
It's like some kind of enchanted ruby?
She had said enchanted, although she was thinking cursed.
Can't really say it's enchanted. Hell, it ain't even a ruby. It's the eyeball of one of those shadow demons. Not easy to come by. You gotta catch the thing as it's slipping from Le Chemin, or as you city folks say, the dreaming road into this world.
You killed one of them? Natalie added this variable to her calculation of the man's strength.
Course not. No need. I cut out the eye and let it loose. When its buddies saw the damned thing had been wounded, they took care of the killing for me.
He lifted the ring to his lips and kissed the stone.
Nasty little couillon. But then they've been refined to be.
Refined?
Course, Shy. Your dreaming road, that's what it does. Story goes, when a witch takes to the road, it's the magic that gets burned away.
He pursed his lips in disapproval and shook his head.
Ain't the magic. It's the humanity that gets smelted away. The impurities of conscience and compassion.
He clapped his hands together, then held them out to her.
empty palms up.
Poof.
Gone. Road leaves nothing behind except the magic and an empty, angry, controllable. He paused on this word.
Spirit.
10 of those. You can take on an army. 100, you could take down the world. But I thought the witches who went there could never return. Oh, pshaw. They don't. Not really. What does slip back in ain't the same as what went out.
Alice came back, Natalie thought aloud, regretting having spoken Alice's name the second the words were out. Emil cocked an eyebrow.
Did she really now?
Natalie cautioned her full mouth to keep shut, but she felt compelled to explain about Alice, to defend her, to wipe the sneer off his face.
We rescued her, her family and I.
Emil remained silent, though his eyes began glistening with humor.
We brought her back from the Dreaming Road.
No one's ever been pulled back from the Dreaming Road unless the road wanted them to be pulled.
That's not true. We used the gravity of rightful destiny.
Natalie could nearly hear Daniel's voice as she spoke the words.
My destiny, our destiny, Alice and mine.
He smirked at her.
Now, who put such nonsense in your head?
Daniel.
She hesitated, wondering how best to explain who Daniel was, what he was.
Our friend Daniel.
It felt weird calling Daniel a friend. In the short time Natalie had known the guy, she had felt unnerved by him, but he had given himself to rescue Alice, and that was enough for her. They might not have been friends while Daniel was still alive, but Natalie made up her mind right there on the fly. They were friends now.
Your friend Daniel?
Emil said, shaking his head, his eyes narrowing in contempt.
You mean the servitor spirit? The one created by your Alice's maman?
This Emil wasn't trying to get information from her. He was trying to give her the impression he was far more in the know than she herself was.
You didn't pull Alice Merrin back. The road spat her out of its own accord. She's one of them, your petite amie.
Well, you mean one of them?
One of those shadows. She's the worst of the bunch. They're an army and your Alice is their general. That Daniel spook. Your girl's friends and family. They done played you for a fool.
That isn't true. You're making this up.
Ain't making nothing up. Not me.
His aftershave started to remind her less of cologne and more of the mortuary soap Frank de Magnan had used to prepare bodies.
Seeing clearly, that's all. You know you're right about one thing. That gravity of rightful destiny has pulled you and Alice Merrin together. But your destiny ain't to love that thing. Your destiny is to kill it.
I would never hurt her.
He leaned forward and guffawed, nearly bending all the way over as he did so. He allowed himself a good long laugh, glancing up at her a few times as he did. Finally, his mirth faded, replaced by something else. Sadness? Sympathy?
I know what you're going through, girl. It kind of does feel like love, don't it? The pull between the hunter and the prey. But it's gonna be her or you. She's the one who ain't gonna leave you with a choice.
You're wrong, Natalie said, stopping short of saying what she was really thinking. This guy was beyond dung. He was a dangerous crazy. The kind of crazy that does not like being called crazy.
You'd never get what you think you want from that girl. Not even if she had it in her to give it to you.
He shook his head.
No, ma fillette. You don't want to love that thing. You want to end her. You ain't never gonna feel complete until her blood is on your hands. That's how it works with some of us, Shelley, folk like you and me. The only one we can love is the one we're born to kill.
Natalie jumped up, determined to fight her way out if she had to. But he stepped aside. She pointed herself toward the door, but he reached out and grabbed her by the wrist.
You don't want to believe me, I understand that. But I know what I'm talking about. This,
he held the ring up before her once again,
came from my wife.
Natalie felt her stomach churning. She shook off his grip and advanced on the door. She was mad enough, frightened enough, to rip it clean off its hinges if she had to. But the door wasn't locked. It flung open so hard the knob punched the interior wall. The last rays of the day's low winter sun shone through the opening, and Natalie gave a quick but heartfelt thanks for the breeze that accompanied them. Natalie was about to cross the threshold when she stopped cold, unable to believe what she was seeing. In front of her were about a dozen men who, at first flush, looked enough alike to be brothers or certainly at least cousins. Her cousins. She scanned their faces, looking for Lincoln or Wiley, but neither was to be found. The men wandered around the overgrown patch of grass before her. They each wore a type of camouflage pattern, some the familiar hunting one, designed to blend in with leaves and bark, others with dull brick-like markings that looked like they'd work better in urban environments. Each man carried a semi-automatic rifle, strapped across his chest. Emil drew up behind her. As the men took note of his presence, they jerked to attention and saluted him.
Bienvenue, ma fillette, he said, to the New World Order.
13. Evangeline lined up a row of lowball glasses along the bar, beneath Daniel's benevolent gaze and crooked, self-conscious smile, rendered so perfectly in the portrait Alice had painted of him. It was an appropriate tribute given that another portrait, one Astrid had painted, had helped bring him to life. And it was that life those who loved Daniel would be gathering here, at Bonne Nouvelle to celebrate. She felt the weight of a stare and, by instinct, sought out its source. Her eyes fell once again on the portrait. It sat flanked by a pair of white votive candles in clear glass holders, left over from the day Evangeline had first met Lincoln here at this very bar, when the sparks between them had been enough to kill the power on the entire block. Was she afraid of losing control as she had in that moment? The conjured Luke's parting words haunted her. It was true. Evangeline was holding back, refusing to trust Lincoln completely. But did she fear the man who could cause her to lose control? Or did she fear what she might become if she lowered her guard too far? She opened a bottle of Irish whiskey and, by sound alone, poured two fingers into the closest glass. Daniel hadn't been Irish, of course, but he had spent most of his existence believing he was a ghost from the Emerald Isle, thanks to the backstory Nicholas and Astrid had given him, and what he'd believed to be true about himself had continued to color him long after he had learned it was a lie. Maybe that's what Evangeline found most human about him. She set the bottle on the bar and lifted the glass, saluting Daniel, then widening the gesture to include Bonne Nouvelle as well. She sipped the whiskey, grimacing at the taste. Honey, vanilla, and orange, with a soupçon of cat piss. Vodka, unflavored and ice cold, that was her poison. The door swept open with magnificent force. Evangeline looked over to find the Vicaire's own Miss Lalaurie Mercion
a 6'4" wall of solid muscle draped in a teal chiffon halter-style gown, hurrying toward her in 6.5-inch stiletto heel platform pumps that conspired to raise the drag queen's stature to nearly the 7-foot mark. Laloie drew near and, beaming down at Evangeline, lifted a heavily bejeweled hand and brushed back a wayward tress of her long lace front wig that had been styled in easy beach waves and dyed a shade not so different from Evangeline's own natural auburn.
"I hope you appreciate the homage."
Evangeline laughed and raised her glass again, this time to Laloie.
"Indeed I do. I know y'all are shutting down early tonight for your..."
She waved a hand in the direction of Daniel's portrait.
"Private event. But I wanted to pop in and tell you goodbye in person."
"Goodbye?"
"Yeah, there's a sea of ignorant and ugly out there, and it feels like high tide is rolling in. Gonna get out of here for a while. Go out and visit my family in Oakland."
"I thought your people were from Mississippi. I didn't know you had relatives in California."
"I didn't say relatives. I said family. You know there's a difference, girl."
"Indeed I do." Evangeline repeated herself and grasped the whiskey bottle. "Care to join me?"
"Oh, good Lord, girl, no. I have one more set to perform and a 6 a.m. flight I gotta be on."
She nodded at Daniel's portrait.
"I'm sorry for your loss."
"I'm sorry we're losing you."
"Aren't you sweet? You may not be losing me, at least not for forever."
Laloie cast a quick glance around the club. Evangeline assumed she was looking for Hugo. "He's in the storeroom with Alice trying to unearth our old karaoke machine."
"Hmm?"
"Hugo."
"Oh, that one."
Laloie waved her hand in the air, the overhead light setting fire to the stones in each of her 5 rings.
"He's all wrapped up in that new friend of his. All tough and manly, just like the straight boys who'd like to kill them both. Guys like Hugo could never, well, he ain't even gonna notice this old girl is gone."
"That isn't true. At least the part about missing you."
Laloie flashed her a wide smile. "Yeah, I guess you're right. But no, I'm not looking for the Marin boy. I'm taking the old place in. It's only now I'm leaving... I'm starting to feel nostalgic. You know, I first started coming here back when they still called the place the Black Cat."
A bejeweled nail pointed to the stage.
"Back when you yourself, Miss Evangeline, was up there working that pole like a fireman sliding down to a 4-alarm fire. You sure were something back then," she said,
then seemed to recognize it as a left-handed compliment.
"Not that you aren't now," she added.
"Strange. I don't remember you."
"And you wondering how you could have missed all this?"
Laloie struck a dramatic pose and made a sweeping gesture that took her in from the top of her wig to the soles of her stilettos. She chuckled.
"Nah, you didn't miss anything. I used to come here in boy drag to look after my sister. My real sister, not the blood one. Maybe you remember her. Tiny little thing."
Laloie raised her hand to the level of Evangeline's shoulders.
"Bright green eyes and long black hair with a streak of red in it. Called herself Regine. She could pass, so she used to dance here a bit. I kept watch in case any of the boys got a little too free with their hands and ran across, well, you know, her boys."
Evangeline did in fact recall the dancer, clearly enough to feel surprised Regine had passed beneath the radar of not just her ordinary 5 senses, but her extrasensory perception too.
"Yes, I do remember Regine," she said. "I haven't thought of her in forever, though. How is she?"
"Damned if I know. She drifted away during Katrina. Probably ended up married to some farmer and teaching Sunday school in Basine, Kansas.
She got out the week before. Me, I was a fool enough to have faith in... well, you know. Evangeline, uncertain what the Queen was getting at, shook her head.
The government?
LaLaurie barked out a laugh.
Yeah. Butter wouldn't melt in your mouth, would it?
She leaned in. I mean people like Hugo and you. And probably that fellow in the picture there, too.
I know what you are.
I know what you all are.
Hugo entered, a dusty cardboard box in his arms, and Alice at his side.
Well, 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 he said, nearly bowling Alice over as he pawned the box off on her. I was wondering if you were going to haul that sagging camel toe tuck of yours in to say goodbye before you took off.
You knew I was leaving?
A spark of hope betrayed the Queen by slipping out from behind her feigned nonchalance. Evangeline's heart nearly broke for LaLaurie. Hugo loved her all right, as best he could and with his entire guarded heart. But the love Hugo had for her was not the kind LaLaurie had always dreamed it would grow into.
Posters with your pancaked puss over the words farewell tour are pasted all over the frickin' quarter. By the way, two dive bars do not a tour make.
You could have come to one of them.
It would have saved me having to hike all over the blessed city in these shoes.
LaLaurie gave Evangeline a sidelong glance that acknowledged she had busted herself. Yes, LaLaurie would have walked 100 miles in those shoes to hear Hugo say he'd miss her. Evangeline looked down, acting like she hadn't picked up on the slip.
When have I ever made your life easier? Hugo asked. There was that one time on August 6, 2000 and never.
Hugo drew near the Queen.
Best day of my life.
LaLaurie blinked her beaded eyelashes with pleasure as Hugo reached into his pocket and fished out a wadded-up dollar from his pocket.
They got a lottery out there in California, don't they?
You know they do.
You take this,
Hugo said, flattening the dollar and offering it to LaLaurie. Evangeline saw a spark move from the tip of Hugo's finger and stretch out to envelop the bill.
You play it on the big lottery, not some damned scratch-off. You don't use it for anything else, you promise. The day you get there.
About time you got around to giving me a tip.
LaLaurie glanced at the bill before slipping it into her padded bra. She pursed her lips.
Cost $2 to play, but I guess I'll have to make up the difference on my lonesome.
I reckon you will. But one of the two will be that one. Promise me.
All right, I promise.
She shrugged her steely shoulders.
Big draw, no scratch. Too stingy to dig a bit deeper in that pocket of his.
This last bit, she muttered.
The day, her voice rose as she patted her wig. The very second I get there.
She grabbed Hugo's wrist, focusing on his watch.
Is that the time? I gotta get back for my next set.
It was clear LaLaurie had only wanted to touch Hugo. She released him slowly, with great tenderness, and strode to the door like she was working a catwalk. Evangeline picked up on a stray thought. LaLaurie had rehearsed this moment in her mind. Dozens, maybe hundreds of times. LaLaurie reached the door and grasped the handle, then looked back over her shoulder with a graceful twist of her neck.
By Norman,
Hugo said, stretching the name out. LaLaurie's eyes flashed, but her lips curled up into a tight smile.
You are such a malevolent little bastard, but I still love you.
She turned back and pushed the door open.
Love you more, Hugo mumbled under his breath.
I heard that, she said, then stepped aside, holding the door open for Fleur,
whose arms were laden with a bouquet half her size. Fleur ducked beneath LaLaurie's arm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. LaLaurie's voice trailed off, and the door closed.
Hugo?
Fleur said. Could you? Hugo rushed forward and relieved her of the load, setting the vase on the end of the bar.
Your friend,
Alice said, joining her brother, balancing the box she'd been holding on a barstool.
She'll never spend that dollar. She'll hold on to it forever.
Hugo tapped a glass.
Barkeep?
He watched as Evangeline poured a shot for him.
She will someday.
She'll drop it on the lottery, when she's ready to move on for real. By letting go, she shall receive. He grabbed the glass and drank it down.
Not everyone is as cavalier as you, dear nephew, Fleur said.
She looked diminished. Her aura seemed to consume the light around her, giving Evangeline the impression she had been outlined in black ink. Without even trying, Evangeline picked up on her feelings. Concern, fear, wounded pride. Fleur's eyes met hers.
My divorce was finalized today. Warren's wedding is Christmas Day.
Where's the bread? Hugo said.
That's why I'm running late, and Lucy didn't come. We're having a bit of a disagreement. Warren sent flowers to each of us today. Hers included an invitation, a surprisingly sincere-sounding one, to participate in the nuptials.
She wants to go to Warren's wedding?
Hugo said, incredulous.
She wants to go home, even if it means living with her father and his child bride.
The father she wanted to put a blood curse on not 6 months ago, Alice said, with the unintentional bluntness of someone to whom being able to speak her mind was still a novelty.
We have worked through all that. She and Warren have been video chatting over the last several weeks, at my urging.
Fleur rushed out the next words, and Evangeline didn't need to use her power to discern she was trying to fend off Hugo's expression of, what, surprise? Sympathy? Contempt?
She and Warren need each other. I'm not going to let anyone's pride, hers, his, or mine, put a wall between them. I only wish it were possible for Lucy to attend the wedding.
But why? Evangeline began, regretting the intercession the very second her lips began to move. This situation was in no way her business or her concern.
You're a class act, Totti, Hugo said,
rescuing Fleur and Evangeline both. He planted a quick kiss on Fleur's temple. Fleur's eyes filled with gratitude, but the warm glow was short-lived. She brushed her bangs back, and it was gone.
And still my daughter isn't speaking to me.
Fleur turned her gaze toward her.
Bar's open?
Evangeline poured her a whiskey and slid it over. Fleur lifted the glass to her lips and sipped. Her shoulders relaxed. She focused on the painting on the bar.
It's hard to think of Daniel as dead, Fleur said,
casting a quick glance around to determine who was in earshot.
I'd only just begun to think of him as alive.
But he was alive, Hugo said.
A man, not a disposable servitor spirit. He may have started out that way, but he developed a rich interior life.
A smile quivered on his lips.
He was even capable of duplicity.
He knocked back his whiskey and grimaced.
Nicholas and Astrid didn't give him any of that, you know? And he didn't get it from that damnable book Astrid used to create him either.
No, Alice said, focusing on the painting she'd done of Daniel. Somehow Daniel had a spark of his own.
You really captured his essence.
Fleur moved side to side as she considered the portrait.
You have a real talent, our Alice.
It takes great skill to make it seem as if the subject's eyes are following you. Hadn't Evangeline thought the same? But this painting went far beyond that. Daniel's eyes did more than follow you. They looked through you.
Fleur glanced around the club. Is it only the four of us? I'd assumed Natalie and the brothers Boudreaux would be joining us. Evangeline expected Hugo to jump in with an answer, but instead he fell silent. A shadow crossed over his face, and he reached for the whiskey bottle. Fleur gave her a cautious, confused look. Evangeline shrugged. Another moment of awkward silence, and Evangeline decided to answer.
Lincoln and Wiley have been called up to Natchitoches.
Called up is an odd phrasing. You make it sound like the draft.
It seems it's more of a formal end-of-year meeting than a Christmas visit. Lincoln described it as a compulsory family cabal with jambalaya and bouilli.
And Natalie?
She too, Alice said, was invited. Or drafted. Though she was happy to volunteer, it's been good for her, connecting with Wiley and Lincoln. It's built a bridge between Natalie and the rest of the Boudreaux.
But Natalie is such a lovely woman, Fleur said. Why would a bridge even be necessary?
Alice fell silent, and Evangeline sensed she was debating whether it was appropriate to be discussing Natalie in her absence.
Hugo had no such qualms.
Natalie's mother, he said, was an outsider, an unpopular one. The Boudreaux haven't exactly shunned Natalie over the years, but they've never reached out to her either. Not even when she went up to Natchitoches after Katrina.
Natalie has been on her own since she was 14, Alice said, as much a simple statement of fact as a condemnation of the larger Boudreaux family.
Evangeline sensed another level of meaning, too. Alice was speaking from the center of her own pain, having been deserted by her family. And by Evangeline, too.
Beautiful, Evangeline said, tracing a finger along the petals of a flower that resembled a rose, except for its coloring, which fell somewhere between blue and deep violet. It wasn't a lie. The bouquet was lovely. But she had only spoken of it to fill the silence, and because she sensed Fleur could use another shot of validation.
Blue rose, Lysianthus. Fleur tapped a wine-colored nail against a similar bloom. I know he was fond of them. The bright blue ones are bachelor's buttons, she said, first gazing sadly at Daniel's portrait, then smirking. In honor of his status as a confirmed bachelor.
And the green ones? Evangeline asked, to continue Fleur's distraction.
Fleur turned to her with what seemed a genuine smile.
Bells of Ireland.
Of course, he wasn't really Irish. If anything, he was a caricature of the Irish, but the idea of a connection to faraway Eire was, I understand, once very important to him.
She took another sip of her whiskey, then reached out to examine the bottle.
It appears great minds do think alike.
Hugo grunted, then craned his neck as he looked out the window to the street. A drab young woman had arrived at the door. She tugged it open and stepped into the bar. She wore no makeup. The glow of the club's predominantly blue-tinted LED lights rendered her complexion a snowy pale. Her brown hair was pulled back in a tight bun. A second woman around the same age followed her into the bar. They wore identical white, long-sleeved, bow-at-the-neck blouses, paired with calf-length skirts. The second woman waited by the door, holding it open, perhaps to facilitate a hasty escape. Evangeline found the pair somehow familiar, but she couldn't place them. She was about to tell them the club was closed for a private function, when Hugo spoke up.
"Sorry, ladies," he said, eyeing them up and down. "Dancer auditions are on the third Thursday of the month."
"Hugo," she began to chastise him, but fell dumb at the sight of Nicholas in the doorway.
"They're with me."
Nicholas walked, full swagger, up to the bar. He acted as if they should applaud the restoration of the rightful monarch.
"You're not welcome here," Hugo said,
puffing up and positioning himself like a territorial cock protecting his hens.
"And neither are your beige brides of Dracula."
Nicholas responded by reaching out and drawing his son into a tight embrace. He nuzzled Hugo's hair, though his gaze remained fixed on Evangeline. Nicholas wanted her to experience his regret, his guilt, to understand how desperately he had missed his son, how deeply he had missed her. Nicholas released Hugo, and Hugo staggered back. The show of paternal affection had landed with more force than any punch could have. Nicholas slipped an arm around Fleur's shoulder, giving her a gentle squeeze, then focused on Daniel's portrait.
"Odd you could love the creation and still hold the creator in such contempt. I know you believe I treated him callously, perhaps even resent me for his end, but I gave him life. I gave him purpose. And for how the rest of it turned out, what can I say? There's no denying I have an inflated ego, but I never wanted to play God."
Nicholas looked at Evangeline with the same self-assuredness that had always at once repulsed and attracted her.
"Oh, come on now. I don't expect a hero's welcome, but we've all made mistakes. You two,"
he pointed back and forth at Hugo and her, "deemed me capable of murdering my own son and conspired against me." He released Fleur and looked down at her.
"And you allowed pieces of our father's body to be passed out like party favors while I was off searching for a way to..."
He hesitated, as Fleur's expression turned to stone.
"To find a solution," he continued, "to our predicament. All in all, I think you should laud me for my magnanimity, or at least pour me a drink."
Evangeline was happy for the suggestion. It gave her something to do. She grabbed the bottle by the neck and eyeballed a half jigger of whiskey. She slid the glass toward him, cringing when his fingers traced over hers. She snapped her hand back and turned to his companions. "Drink?"
"No, no," Nicholas answered for them. "It's requisite they maintain a sober mind for the sake of..."
"It's you," Alice blurted out, tilting her head as she examined the young women. "You were at Précerçon, at Celestin's trial." In a flash, Evangeline too recognized the women. They were the goth girls Alice had warned away before taking the knife to Celestin's corpse. But their black coats, thick eyeliner, and lavender hair were gone, replaced by this garb that made them look like missionaries. Nicholas's eyes caught hers, a mischievous glint in them. Missionaries. He had planted the image in her mind. He had never possessed such an ability before. Nicholas flashed her a tight, knowing smile and opened his mind up to her like a movie screen. With a single thought, he laid it all bare before her. Yes, these women were missionaries, all right, of a faith Nicholas himself was founding. He had found a way to recharge his failing batteries. Vampirism through adoration, similar to the way performers feed off the energy of the audience, only intentionally and without any thought of giving anything back. These women were his acolytes, and if Nicholas had made his triumphant return, Evangeline was sure they were only two from among a legion. Blood, sex, dreaming, intoxication, adoration, deprivation, madness. These are the gates to magic. The words came to her in a separate stream. Had Nicholas projected them, or had they surfaced from somewhere in her own mind? Before Evangeline could delve deeper to discover their source, Nicholas raised his glass in salute.
To Daniel.
There was a moment of uncertainty, then Fleur seconded him. To Daniel. It takes a special person to learn he doesn't exist, then go on with his life anyway. Hugo seemed to float up through a cloud of confused resentment, but he too raised his glass.
To the only father I ever knew, and mother too, for that matter.
Well, Nicholas said, there is that.
He returned his tumbler to the bar.
I'll leave you to your further reminiscences. But first, I must admit, I had an ulterior motive for crashing your celebration of our dear Daniel.
Anyone surprised here?
Hugo turned from Evangeline to Alice to his aunt. He focused on Nicholas's acolytes.
Watchtower twins? No?
Nicholas ignored Hugo's sarcasm.
I'm hoping you'll join me, Will. Actually, I'm hoping all of the region's remaining witches will join together in reviving a lapsed tradition. The longest night.
Hugo snorted.
I think you're forgetting, dear old grandpère. Celestin slaughtered half the witches between Galveston and Biloxi. Unlikely the survivors are going to show up for a sequel.
Celestin's atrocities are the very reason I think rekindling this tradition is important. Of course, Celestin didn't act alone.
He turned his focus to Evangeline.
Your aunts colluded with him. A joyful longest night celebration would give us all an opportunity to repair our image and, more importantly, help our community heal.
You have my support, Fleur said, then turned to her nephew and niece. Oh, come on. It's exactly what we need, all of us. It's like a roving masked ball meets Burning Man. Not only are intoxicants and devilry condoned, they're encouraged. You'll love it. Especially you, Hugo. It struck Evangeline that Fleur was working too hard to sell this idea. Nicholas, she surmised, had already gotten Fleur's buy-in, and no doubt his sister had proposed Daniel's wake as the perfect place for him to buttonhole them. All of them together, all of them emotionally vulnerable. Taking advantage of their vulnerability didn't feel like something Fleur would involve herself in naturally. Evangeline studied the two as they stood near each other, watching the ebb and flow of energy between them. Evangeline could see it written in their auras. Nicholas was holding something over his sister's head.
I won't beg, Nicholas said, but do know you're welcome, more than welcome. Your support would mean the world to me, as it would give me hope perhaps not all is lost between us, that my relationship with each of you might still be salvageable.
That, Alice began, is a lot of weight to place on a single evening.
Relax, Nicholas, Hugo said, cutting his sister off. Fleur had me at Molly in mischief. He shrugged. How bad could it be anyway? He said, looking everywhere except at his father. Oh yeah, that's right. It could be hell on earth. Literally.
He caught hold of Alice's hand and tugged her toward the door. Alice cast a surprised glance back at them as her brother conducted her out the door and onto the street. Nicholas turned to Evangeline, a silent question hanging between them. Lincoln and I will both be there. You can count on us. 14.